imagine there's no heaven.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Matthew DeClaire, and this is Equal Time for Free Thought, where we promote rationality, critical thinking, and scientific naturalism in an attempt to create positive social change. My guest today is Dr. Brian Green, a theoretical physicist and string theorist with relatively lengthy resume, so bear with me. He's the author of four books, including The Fabric of the Cosmos and The Elegant Universe, both of which became PBS specials that he hosted. He's co-founder and current board chairman of the World Science Festival, co-founder of the new and free online series of science courses at World Science U, and a professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University. I can list some of his media appearances, including his most recent visit to the Colbert Report, but I think you get the general idea. So thanks for coming on the show today, Professor Green.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So you're known as a science communicator. With World Science U, I'd like to start with that because it seems to be the most recent. How did World Science U come about? And tell us a little bit about what it is and what its goals are.
Well, World Science U is a new platform that we just launched about 3 weeks ago to create a place where people can take courses online, which is, of course, something that has taken the educational community by storm over the last couple of years, but to create a new kind of educational experience where it's not simply filming lectures and making them widely available, which is a fine thing to do, but it doesn't leverage the internet, leverage the power of the digital realm to create a different kind of educational experience. It's just trying to do what we ordinarily do and deliver it through a laptop computer. So we're trying to create educational experiences which are far more interactive, far more visual, which I think is critical to understanding abstract ideas in math and physics. If you can't see it, then it's very hard to have a real mental grasp. And that's the goal of what we're giving to the world.
Well, it seems like for you that's a special challenge as opposed to many other sciences out there because your focus is string theory. And I want to get into a little bit about what that is, but the first thing I want to know is when you first started out developing your career as a science communicator, why did you think that string theory would be something that people would be, A, interested in, and B, that you would be able to communicate in a way that the general public could understand?
Well, it's a good question. And back in 1995, I guess it would be, or 96, when I started to think about writing a book for a general audience, at that point, all I did was 18 hours of physics research every day, and that was, you know, the sole focus. When I started to think about writing a book on string theory and approached an agent in order to potentially have a book like that sold, he called me back, and without even introducing himself, he said to me, you know, why the, and I won't say it, or maybe you can bleep it out. Can we be completely free with our curse words in this environment here?
I can bleep it out.
Bleep it. So he said to
if
me,
if it was live, we couldn't do
good,
it.
Good. So he said to me, you know, why the f*** would anyone want to read a book on string theory? That were the first words out of this fellow's mouth. And it was the right question to ask, because as you're saying, at that time in particular, it was such an esoteric idea, so unknown to the general public. How would you rope somebody in to want to read a whole book on this subject? And my view was, and still is, and I think the data of the last 15 years has sort of borne it out, people are hungry to know what's happening at the cutting edge of ideas. They want to understand what Einstein said. They want to understand what Bohr and Schrodinger and Heisenberg said in quantum mechanics, and they want to understand what's happened since. I mean, those guys are really smart, but they're a long time ago. What have we been doing in the last 20 or 30 years to advance our understanding of big questions like, how did the universe begin? You know, where are the ingredients that make up everything around the world around us? Where do they all come from? How do stars and galaxies form? What will it be like in the far, far future? And these are big questions that I think we have an affinity for as humans. And that's really ultimately what a theory like string theory tries to address.
Well, when it comes to something like string theory, I understand that the majority of that work is really in mathematics. So is there a way that you can explain how theoretical physicists in particular make the jump from mathematics to making real-world predictions about what the universe looks like, such as the idea that there could be an infinite number of universes?
Yeah, so when we play with mathematical equations, we have a corresponding dictionary telling us that symbol represents this kind of feature of the physical world. Now, when you take high school physics, you have a clearer sense of what that dictionary looks like. If you recall, you probably learned about Newton's second law with F equals ma. So F is the force. That's the amount of push that a rock or a block is experiencing. M is the mass of that object, how much heft it has. A is the acceleration, that is how quickly its speed will change because you're pushing on it. So even if you don't remember the details of the equations on the board, every symbol corresponds to something in the world. Now, that dictionary becomes ever more sophisticated and esoteric and oblique as you go ever deeper into physics, because you begin to require constructs that are not intuitive, everyday things that you see. In quantum mechanics, you talk about the wave function, which is a construct that captures the probability that a particle might be here or it might be there. And we embody that notion of probability in a mathematical function that solves an equation that any undergraduate can solve in the simple cases, at least, or my students can do the complex cases, I hope.
Right.
And in that way, you're doing these equations, but at the end of the day, you look at the output and you say, aha, that symbol tells me this about the world. That symbol tells me that about the world.
At what point is it can a theoretical physicist be able to trust the mathematics over what feels like a logical conclusion? I was thinking of one example of this is this idea that there are more than three dimensions of space. It's so counter to our understanding of the universe. We have no way of really understanding what it means to have extra dimensions of space. Most people, I think, if they were to look at the math and reach that conclusion, I would assume that the response would be to say, something must be wrong with our math, or that the math doesn't, the mathematics may be accurate, but don't necessarily tell us anything about the real world. So how do you make those distinctions?
And in the case you're describing, extra dimensions of space, that reaction, that conclusion may well in the end be correct. It may be that the math is not relevant when it tells us that there are extra dimensions. It may be that the world really does have the three dimensions that we experience in day-to-day life. But I would caution you to look at the history of theoretical physics, where in the past there were other ideas, not extra dimensions of space, but other ideas that were seemingly as nonsensical as extra dimensions of space that people did not believe. Take Einstein, right? So Einstein's own mathematics in the general theory of relativity predicted that there should be objects like black holes. These are incredibly dense objects. Like, take the sun, you have to squeeze it down to a couple miles across. That seems illogical, right? It seems nonsensical. The sun is pretty damn big. How are you ever going to squeeze it down to a couple miles across? So Einstein himself rejected this conclusion of his equations when it was pointed out to him that the math suggested there would be black holes. But now we have overwhelming evidence that black holes are real. Another good example, which involves Einstein too, is not just Einstein, but he's sort of a good foil for this kind of exercise. His math showed that the universe should be expanding, stretching over time. When he was alerted to this fact by two individuals, Alexander Friedmann first, and then Georges Lemaître, a Belgian priest who also has a PhD in physics, both times Einstein said, no way, you guys are out of your minds, right? You're pushing the math too far. You're doing exactly what you were asking me, taking the math too seriously. And then in 1929, Edwin Hubble observes distant galaxies, finds they're all rushing away. The universe is expanding. So time and time again, Einstein had to kind of slap himself and say, damn, why didn't I believe the mathematics? And in fact, this is sort of a long answer to a short question, but Steven Weinberg, who's a Nobel laureate in physics down in UTF, University of Texas, Austin, he once said something very insightful, which was, the problem is that not that we physicists take our math too seriously, is that we don't take it seriously enough. Oftentimes the math is staring at us and we don't believe it until it is established through the observations. Now that's of course the point when it's confirmed, but he's saying we should have more confidence that our math really is telling us true things about the world.
What would that imply, taking it more seriously? Just the reason I ask the question is because I'm thinking about how else would you be able to interpret whether or not the theory that is proposed through the mathematics is valid?
Well, it definitely is the case, and let me be real clear about this. The only time you know that the math is right is when it makes a prediction, however strange it might be, that's confirmed through experiment or observation. That is the only, that's not the gold standard, that's the only standard, okay? Now, having said that, I got to tell you, there are many times in my own career where I'm working on equations and they're describing stuff and I sort of feel like, this is a game. It's a fun game and I'm enjoying manipulating the symbols and it's fun to write up the paper which has these sort of unusual ideas in it. But it's not real. It's not really describing the world. There's sort of some feeling inside, that sort of devil in the back of your head. And taking it more seriously would basically allow oneself to not second guess whether or not this is connecting to reality, but rather go along with the flow even further, assuming, hoping that one day the adjudication from observation or experiment will happen. So I can't really say that it holds us back, this notion, is the math really describing the world? So it's not as though Steven Weinberg was really telling us, change what you're doing. But he was really more in a poetic way commenting on the history. And the history in that particular case that really made him think that was, there's something called the microwave background radiation. This is heat left over from the Big Bang. There are fellows in the 1940s who were calculating that there should be this heat left over. They were making predictions about it. None of the observational astronomers took them seriously enough to start to look for this stuff. It was 20 years later when another group of physicists did their own calculations, came to the same conclusion, and again, nobody was looking for it. They started to build their own experiment to look for it when, by chance, a couple guys at Bell Labs turned an antenna to the sky and happened to serendipitously capture these photons, the heat left over from the Big Bang. So there's another wonderful example. The math was saying it. No one believed. The math said it again. No one paid any attention. Then somebody accidentally discovers it. And that's a great example, again, of how the math really can lead the way.
Are there circumstances under which the mathematics has said something and turned out not to be true?
Oh yeah, most of the time.
So
you have to definitely look at the larger picture,
right,
and say to yourself, look, math can be really good, but it does take a certain kind of artist sensibility. I don't know how else to frame it, where you kind of have a good intuition as to which math is right. And that's what distinguishes the great theoretical physicists from the good ones. They have that sensibility.
And speaking of artists' intuition, in order to communicate this stuff to a general public, you need to use things like metaphors. But as I'm leaping into science writing and continuing to talk about this stuff, I'm finding how difficult this can be. How do you begin tackling issues like this, especially when you started writing your books? And I'd like you to begin by explaining in particular how you've tried to explain things like extra dimensions.
Well, when it comes to ideas that are very foreign to everyday experience, the one of the most powerful approaches is to find an analogy that is in the real world so that you aren't forcing the person to think hard to understand the analogy. Because if they have to work so hard to understand the analogy, then by the time you say, and much like that analogy that I just showed you, here's the real deal, you've already lost them. So there are examples in the real world where there are objects that have big and obvious dimensions, but smaller curled up dimensions that are harder to see. So a great version of that analogy is a garden hose, which is one that many of us use to explain extra dimensions. We say, look, imagine a garden hose that's really, really long. It's easy for you to see the length of the garden hose, but it's harder for you to see the curled up circular girth of the garden hose. And in fact, if you made that garden hose really skinny, really thin, make it as skinny as a straw or skinny as a hair, then it's again still easy to see the length of that object, but very hard to see the thickness, the curled up portion of that object. And then from that analogy, we say, well, look, there's an example where one dimension, one direction is big, one dimension, one direction is small and curled up, hard to see. Maybe our universe is like that. We have three big directions in which you can walk, three big dimensions, left, right, back, forth, and up, down. But who's to say that that's everything? Maybe like the garden hose or the piece of dental floss, maybe there's a curled up component to space that's all around us, too small for us to see. And that kind of idea, you know, that kind of analogy, you know, another version of that is take a carpet, right? Imagine you have an enormous carpet. It's easy to see it. But what about the curled up fibers of the carpet? They're harder to see. You have to go way down, put your eyeball right on top of the carpet to see that tiny additional dimension. So these sort of real world examples where there's big dimensions that are easy to see and curled up dimensions that are harder help people make that leap.
In the case of something like the dimensions, it still sounds as if the only way to really talk about it is by talking about it in terms of still the three dimensions that we know, because there's no other alternative.
Absolutely right.
So are there any ways in which you ever feel as if the metaphors come close but still fail to really get across the ideas that you put forward and that other people have put forward that you see in the mathematics?
Oh, I would say not that there are times. Every time that's the case. Every metaphor fails at some point, because it's an approximation to rigorous mathematical ideas, but you're relinquishing the rigor in favor of trying to open up the ability of people who don't have technical training in math to understand what you're talking about. And the way I handle that typically is, especially in the most egregious cases, I use a metaphor. And then afterwards, hopefully where the person has got some idea of the physics that I wanted to communicate, I say, hey, you know what, that metaphor? Here's where it fails. And I point it out where it fails in order that if the person really went along with me for their journey, they know when to stop using the metaphor to further their own creative thinking about it. You see, I can't tell you the number of times that people encounter some popularization of physics. Assume that that's not just a popular translation. They assume it's the real thing, and then they spend a dozen years in their basement with a single light bulb trying to push the ideas further based upon what they learned through that translation. And it's kind of heartbreaking. I've gotten documents, as my colleagues have too. It's not just me by any means. I've gotten documents from folks who say, hey, here's my theory. And they send a 100-page document where they've spent clearly 20 or 30 years. And one guy even told me, he said, you know, I lost my job. My wife divorced me. But I know this is my life's calling. This is my life's work. And I have to do this. And here it is. And you look at it and you're like, oh, my God. He thought that sort of popular description that he read anywhere, not necessarily mine, in, you know, Scientific American or the Science Times, you know, or whatever, thought that was it. And now it was up to him to push it forward when all that was a pale approximation that came from metaphors and analogies to mathematical ideas.
Is there a way then, it sounds like there is a way, to take ideas and turn them into mathematics rather than the other way around?
That's definitely the case. And when you're doing research in the field, you are going back and forth between those two languages all the time. And it depends on your style. My style very much is one of thinking about the ideas, embodying the ideas mathematically. The mathematics, you then use it to push the ideas further. Then you stare at the math and say, what did that just tell me? So it's a back and forth thing. There are some folks who are almost purely mathematical in their thinking. They almost never step out of the equations until maybe the very end to say, you know, interpret what it is that they found. And there are others who are very visual, who rarely set the mathematics. Maybe they have graduate students or postdocs. They can sort of see the big picture, and now it's just a matter of the details being worked out by someone who's technically competent to translate the imagery and ideas into mathematical language. So, yes, that is a thing that happens all the time. But you're right. If you then want to go from the rigorous idea to ordinary English language, there's almost always a loss of fidelity in that process.
I know there are definitely many critics to string theory. What are some of the best arguments that you've heard against string theory, and how would you challenge them?
Yeah, so the best arguments against string theory are ones that I'm fond of articulating myself and often do. So again, when I write a book, I wrote a book on string theory, sure, I'm spending part of the time explaining the ideas, why they're exciting, why it is that, you know, a few thousand people around the world who've spent dozens of years in training have decided to spend their professional lives advancing. Sure, that's part of what makes the book interesting. But I also spend part of the time saying, hey, here are the challenges. Here's where we have not lived up to what we've hoped to have gotten. I think that's a vital part of giving a balanced story. So specifically, the big issue with string theory is, does it actually describe our world, right? Can it make a definite prediction about what should be found, either at the Large Hadron Collider, say in Geneva, Switzerland, or with powerful observations of deep space? Does it make a definitive prediction? And if that prediction is not borne out, the theory is wrong. That's the main failure of string theory. It doesn't do that. It doesn't make that kind of a definitive statement that would allow the theory to be proved wrong. And that's not a good thing for a theory. Now, the response to it is, however long we've been working on string theory, and the modern version came to life roughly 1985. So let's call it, I don't know, 20 years, is that right? 30 years. 30. Let's call it 30 years. Yeah, I know, I'm getting old. It's ridiculous. You know. So I actually started working on this 30 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, I started as a graduate student in at Oxford in the mid-1980s. So I was there right at the beginning of the modern version. And the thing to bear in mind is it's an enormously ambitious theory to put together gravity and quantum mechanics into the unified theory that Albert Einstein himself was looking for 30 years of his own life but never found. This is a big, big challenge. Moreover, even beyond clearly it being a monumental project, concretely, string theory really flexes its muscles at distance scales that we don't have the technology to probe. The Large Hadron Collider can probe down to, I don't know, call it 10 to the minus 18, 19 meters, something like that. String theory really comes into its own, at least in the conventional formulation, at about 10 to the minus 35 meters. So roughly, let's call it a billion times smaller than we can probe with technology. So right there, you see it's going to be a challenge to test the theory. And it's not just string theory. Any theory that tries to put gravity and quantum mechanics together, I don't care what you call it, is really going to come to life in these tiny, tiny domains. It doesn't mean that theories are fundamentally untestable. It means it's very hard to test them. And that's why we're, as of yet, unable to make the kind of statements like, next week, the Large Hadron Collider, we're going to look for this. If we don't find it, string theory is wrong. So that's the big issue. And I'm out on the table with it completely. Everybody, I want people to know about it. We're not hiding it. That's where we stand.
Does it ever drive you crazy that there are a good deal of people out there that take a look at the kind of work that you do, at least in terms of the physics, the work, and say, you're wasting your time?
No, it doesn't bother me at all because, first off, what scientific research is all about is taking a chance. And anybody who's not willing to take a chance is, in my sense, so short-circuiting their capacity to make a big breakthrough that I find that sad. So yes, there are many areas of science where you can just plot along, and it's important. And in fact, there are many areas of science where you can plot out your next 20 years to some extent. And if that suits someone's personality and they're pushing science forward, so be it. But there are many others who view science as an opportunity to really revolutionize our understanding of the universe, not just make tiny incremental pushes forward. And with that comes big risk. And part of the big risk is you could be wasting your time. You could be going down an alley that in the end you realize was a blind one that didn't yield any deep insight. And that's the risk that many people are willing to take, including me.
I think we have actually skipped over what string theory is.
Yeah, sure. So string theory is an attempt to build this unified theory that, as I mentioned before, Einstein perhaps is widely recognized as articulating as a goal way back in the 1930s, 1940s. So if we succeed, ultimately we'd in some sense have one equation that would describe the big stuff in the universe, stars and galaxies, the small stuff, molecules, atoms, and subatomic particles, and everything in between. Sort of one master principle, and we say, aha, that's what makes it all tick. And from a concrete standpoint, what is string theory base its fundamental idea on is the notion that at very small scales, matter is not made up of little dots, little particles, the kind of thing that we learn about in high school, electrons and little quarks. If your high school teacher was really good, he or she taught you about that. And the model of those in the traditional formulation is little tiny dots, no machinery inside. And the idea of string theory is that there is finer machinery in those particles. And the machinery that we envision is a little tiny filament of energy. It looks string-like. And that string can vibrate in different patterns. And the different vibrational patterns would correspond to the different kinds of particles. So it's a kind of pretty idea. It's as if the music that these little strings can play corresponds to the different kinds of particles that make up the rich structures in the world around us. That's the basic idea.
And I understand the strings are one-dimensional.
That's right. So again, in the most conventional formulation, and this theory has gone through its own developments over the last 15, 20 years, but yes, the strings would be objects that have only length. They wouldn't have any thickness, they wouldn't have any width, they'd have only length. So it's sort of hard to picture that kind of an object. But the interesting thing is when quantum mechanics comes along, it always fuzzes things out. It makes things jitter on tiny scales. So in some sense, there would be a little bit of thickness, quantum thickness, if you will, in addition to the length, which would be the dominant component of the spatial extent of these ingredients, hypothetical ingredients, the strings.
Why can't there be two? I lost the word.
Dimensions to an object?
Not dimensions. When it comes to talking about Albert Einstein trying to take the two theories at the large scale, the small scale, why
right.
can't there just be two?
There could be. And in fact, there's a very famous and influential physicist at the Institute for Advanced Study named Freeman Dyson, who in a review of one of my books, in the New Yorker Review of Books, said just that. He said, look, you got gravity from Einstein, general relativity, use it for stars and galaxies and big stuff. And he says, look, we've got quantum mechanics. Even he was instrumental in developing quantum mechanics. And use that to describe the small world. And you don't need to put them together. Just have two theories for two different domains. And I don't know how he could have said that. And I'm not sure what he means. And I've never encountered anybody who could really articulate it in a way that illuminated the perspective, because you see, there are domains in our universe, two of which we actually already mentioned. Black holes is a good example. So a black hole arises when a star collapses in on itself. It uses its nuclear fuel. It can no longer support its own mass, its own weight, and it implodes. Now, as it implodes, it gets smaller and smaller in size. It still has the mass. It's still the massive object that it was. So you need a theory of gravity because it's got so much mass. And then you also need a theory of quantum mechanics because its size has gotten so small. And you need both of those theories at the same time. No longer is there a clean separation of the big stuff and the small stuff because a big thing has collapsed and become a small thing. The Big Bang is another good example where you envision, you know, the entire universe in some sense is crushed to a small size, which then itself swells outward and creates the universe as we know it. But, you know, you need a theory of gravity because there's so much stuff there in such a small volume. And because it's a small volume, you need quantum mechanics. So again, it's an example where there's no clean separation of the big and the small. So I don't see how you can avoid unifying the big and the small if you want to understand everything.
What happens if you try to use both together to explain something like a black hole?
That's what people initially tried to do. And what happens is the mathematics goes haywire. The mathematics, basically, you ask any question of it, and you do your calculation, and the number infinity crops up at the end. And you're like, what am I going to do with that? That, you know, there aren't devices that measure infinity. That's not a real prediction. I mean, bear in mind that when a calculation yields infinity as its answer, it doesn't mean that you are slightly off. It means that nature is slapping you in the face and saying you're doing something really dumb. You're doing something really wrong. That's nature's way of taking out the ruler and wrapping your knuckles. So it doesn't work if you just try to, in the most straightforward way, merge general relativity and quantum mechanics.
I think then maybe there's a misunderstanding from people who don't know mathematical language very well between that idea of reaching an answer that leads you to infinity, as opposed to the idea, for example, put forward by mathematics that suggests there could be an infinite number of universes. So what's the distinction?
Very different, there? Yeah. So when I'm referring to infinity in the answer to the previous question, I'm referring to infinity popping up as an answer to a question that we know has to be finite. So for instance, the kind of calculations that we do in physics, if quantum mechanics is involved, we want to calculate the probability that something is going to happen. That's what quantum mechanics tells us is the way in which physics is done. Once quantum theory is in the story, those are the calculations you're doing. Now, for probability to make sense, the probability needs to be between 0 and 1, or 0% and 100%, if you want to talk percentages. A 30% chance, we know what that means. 80% chance, we know what that means. 100% chance, we know what that means. But 101% chance? 110% chance, 1,000% chance it's going to happen, an infinite percent chance it's going to happen, we don't have any idea what that means. So it's not that it means it's a big chance, it means nonsense. Now, there are other questions about the world which are not framed in terms of quantum probabilities, such as, does space go on forever? That's not a probabilistic statement per se. We're talking about a length. The number of universes, again, that's not intrinsically a probabilistic statement. There could be one universe, two universe, three universe, five universe, 100, 1,000, maybe an unlimited number. We know what that means. At least it's a statement that parses. It's within the vernacular of math. It works as a statement. But infinite probability, utter nonsense. And that's the difference between the two.
Well, we're having a great talk here, and I think it's worth pointing out now that we're halfway through. You're listening to WBAI on 99.5 FM. This is Equal Time for Free Thought. I'm Matthew LeClaire, and my guest today is Brian Green. We're talking about a lot. We're talking about quantum mechanics. We're talking about quantum physics. We're talking about string theory. Let's say that Brian Green is right.
A good assumption. I have absolutely no idea.
If it turns out to be true. What would that do for the world aside from, it almost sounds foolish when I ask the question now, but aside from telling us about the fundamental nature of the universe, would there be any way of taking string theory and applying it to actual things that we do or ways in which we live?
Yeah. So first I would simply say it's really important for people to know that whereas I may be one of the people that speaks about string theory the most in public, there are many, many people that work on it. Have been responsible for most of the development of the subject. So the question is, if string theorists as a community were right, what would that mean? And it's very hard to answer that question. And I love to reflect back on a similar question that you could have asked in, say, let's call it 1924. Let's say in this chair you had Niels Bohr, one of the pioneers of quantum mechanics. And you say, Niels, you know, if you're right and quantum mechanics is correct, I'm sure he would have said, no, it's not that there's a community of quantum physics. He was really the guy. So you would have had the guy right there. What will it do for the world? And I guess, I don't know what he would have said, but I think he would have said, you know, we are talking about the physics of tiny things, you know, molecules, atoms, subatomic particles like electrons that's so far removed from everyday life that we're not really trying to change how people live. We're just really just trying to understand stuff. And the wonderful thing about that example is that now we are, you know, 80, 90 years later. And the fact that we're sitting here and you've got this beautiful laptop computer and you've got that cell phone in your pocket And who knows, you or a loved one might have been saved by an MRI machine that can look inside the body. All of this stuff and anything else that has an integrated circuit in it really owes its existence to our deep understanding of quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics allows you to understand how these particles behave, which means you can manipulate their motion in a way that's effective to do good things for the world. So from 1920-something till today, you went from, nah, we're just trying to figure out stuff, understanding, to radical revolution in how we live our lives. And that pattern is one that might well hold true with string theory, or even if it's not string theory, whatever replaces string theory, whatever the unified theory is, assuming there is one, I can well imagine that here in the 21st century we say, you know what, we're pretty much just trying to understand deep stuff about how the world works. Noble, but pretty far removed from everyday experience. And maybe it's 100, 500, 1,000 years, I don't know, maybe much less. Once we have that theory and we understand stuff, we can begin to use it to manipulate things, and in that way maybe change the world in dramatic ways, just as quantum physics has.
So I guess that leads to the question about, with all the different sciences out there, all of the different fields, why did you feel early on that this was something that you wanted to study as opposed to all the other things that are out there? And second, why did you feel it was so important to get a general public to understand it?
Yeah, well, my own journey, you know, as a kid, I think as many theoretical physicists probably would say too, I was a math kid. You know, I was just totally fascinated by numbers, which was nothing to do with physics. It was just the fact that the numbers worked, you know, with very little understanding, knowing how to multiply and divide and think things through, you could do stuff, which was very exciting for a little kid. And then later on, as I began to learn that the math wasn't just a game, that the math could be tied into a deep understanding of reality, that was a radical moment for me, because I was like, oh, holy smokes, these calculations can actually tell you stuff about how the world works. And as I then went into college, I got totally fascinated by a union of math and physics due to Einstein, general relativity. And I didn't understand general relativity when I was, say, a junior in college, but nevertheless, I walked around with a book on general relativity with me all the time. It was Steven Weinberg's book on general relativity. And it's slightly embarrassing, but I've told this story before, so I'm, you know, I would sometimes take out the book and kind of caress the surface of the book because I loved the ideas. Even though I didn't understand them, the geometry that Einstein was using, and then the physics of gravity, knitting these two beautiful subjects together was just thrilling to me. And then finally, I did learn the subject, I think as a senior in college, and that was really where my home base was, gravity. And then when string theory came along, and it was taking gravity and quantum mechanics and putting those together, that was like, you know, a miracle for a graduate student that there was all of a sudden a way to go further with gravity. And that's really what propelled me to do this work as a graduate student. And then, you know, for your final question, in terms of bringing it to a general audience, I've always felt that it's a tragedy that the world at large is shut out from these wondrous ideas merely because most people don't speak the language of math. So to translate these beautiful ideas into ordinary language has always felt to me a vital thing to do. And when I began to play around with doing it, it was fun. It seemed to be effective. People enjoyed it. And that sort of propelled me on this parallel track that I'm on now as well.
How do you manage both?
I don't. It's hard, right? I mean, I had a real good answer for that question up until about 9 years ago, right? So up until 9 years ago, the way I lived my life was I would do physics by day, and then I would do writing and other stuff by night. And then, you know, I had a kid. I got married after having even had a kid, you know, so I had a family, and all of a sudden the nights went away. There is no night any longer. So it's much more difficult for me, and I just do my best to try to cordon off time for each time of the day where I won't do one versus the other so that I can get something done in the research domain, something done in the science for the public domain. But look, like when I'm filming a NOVA program, that plan goes out the window, right? I mean, from 7 in the morning to like 8 at night, you're filming. What are you going to do? And then you're working on the writing of it, the animations, and the, you know. So I do my best, but it's a challenge.
How much time do you usually get to devote to doing the physics that you like to do?
It depends on when. So, you know, if there's a pressing project with a deadline, like a television program, virtually none. When it's a more ordinary time, when I can structure my day at will, then, you know, I can carve out a couple hours, 3-4 hours a day. And I find, you know, if you can get 3 to 4 hours of good research work in a day, that's pretty good. The brain gets fried. It's hard to be fresh on the ideas. But the other thing, of course, is students. And students are a big help because I have some really good students, which means if there's some object, idea, research project that I'm excited about, they're right there with me, and it's a great opportunity for them to push the mathematical ideas forward, to write the computer programs that will test the various things that we're kicking around. So in that way, it's a very helpful thing to have a research group with hungry, brilliant young students who just need to be propelled in the right direction, and then they can push the ideas forward.
So if you weren't talking to me right now and you were over at Columbia instead of here at the World Science Festival offices, which we'll get to in a little bit, what would be the type of thing that you would do as soon as you walked into the room, you sat down, and you're thinking about what?
Oh, well, the very first thing that all of us do is we look at the archive of papers. We have this rolling archive where people post their papers every day and you see it the next day, because often what we do is an iteration, an elaboration, hopefully a spark of brilliant idea that comes from seeing what other people are doing. We don't work in a vacuum. Almost nobody does. So you read what people have been doing. You see what's relevant to whatever project that you have been working on, and you try to, through those collective readings and your own work, to try to push things forward. So that's sort of the first thing. The next thing is I often will meet with my students. So we'll get together. They'll show me their progress. They'll say, hey, I'm stuck over here. I'll say, hey, why don't you try this or that? And they're like, oh, I wish I would have thought of that. Or they're like, oh, that's a silly idea. We tried that. It didn't work, one of the two. And in that way, we keep the research program moving forward.
So I just mentioned World Science Festival. What is the World Science Festival, and how did the idea come about?
Yeah, so World Science Festival is this nonprofit organization that I co-founded back in 2008 with Tracy Day, who is a broadcast journalist at the time, was working various freelance jobs, but her home for many years with ABC News, where she produced some of the best programs on television in the nonfiction domain, Nightline This Week with David Brinkley and so forth. She also happens to be my wife. And when we got together, we felt like there's this wonderful opportunity to put science and journalism together in a way that hadn't really been done. She got very excited about various scientific ideas and realized that for decades she and her colleagues kind of shunned science, ran away from science. The expectation was that the general public wasn't interested in science. They wanted government and politics and history and current things that are happening in the world, and that's what gets people excited. And when she began to realize that all that stuff is good, but some of the scientific ideas almost transcend, talk about issues that are relevant to all of humanity through all of time or all the universe or all of time, she got very excited about that, and we decided to put our expertise together to create a place that would be dedicated to generating public programming. In the live space is where we began, live public programming, 5 days each year. We started in 2008, end of May, and our first year we had 122,000 people come to the events, some in theaters, some in performing arts centers, some in museums. The idea was not in a university classroom. This is meant to be a place where science is experienced fully, not just in the brain, but in the body, the heart, the mind, all put together. So we had dance performances on science. We had straight science debates. We had other things that involved science and music, science and theater, science and film. In that way, basically showing the wide reach of the science, its tentacles, if you will, reaching out into the culture in many different ways. And since then, the festival has just continued to attract, large, excited audiences. And now we're in our seventh year and we're starting to move into the digital space. So not just live programming, but also digital programming.
So what's going to be the live programming for this coming?
So there's a lot of stuff happening. I'm involved in a program on quantum mechanics that will be one of those more straightforward debates about open problems in quantum mechanics, of which I think there are some and others may disagree, and we'll hash that out in front of a excited audience. And then there is a wonderful program that's being done, for instance, just to give you a sense of the breadth of things, at the Intrepid, you know, the ship, where there's going to be a large format film. And I don't know if I'm allowed to release what that film is, but it's a current film that has to do with space. And we'll have a variety of astronauts who will be there to sort of take the conversation of the film forward with an audience of meant to be, you know, kids and families. So we go everywhere from the high end, where it's really meant to be an audience that's specifically interested in one area of science, to things that are good for kids who are 5 or 6, 7 years old.
Have you seen, my guess is probably not considering your schedule, but the new Cosmos?
So Neil Tyson's a friend of mine, and I've known about him doing this for a number of years, even in the early days when he was pitching it to PBS, and ultimately he moved to Fox with the project. So I've been sort of following at a distance. So I ultimately will see, but I have seen the first episode, which I enjoyed. I thought he did a really nice job.
Yeah, I was just wondering what your take was on this idea of bringing it to a station like Fox, something that's that big. Do you think that that's a worthwhile endeavor?
Yeah, I think it's a hugely worthwhile endeavor, because when you do a program on PBS, I think the goal is always to bring new people in. But my suspicion is that you're reaching the PBS audience that already sees the value and importance of science. So if you can take a program to a station like Fox or any other network, and in that way bring the excitement of science to an audience that otherwise would be watching Dancing with the Stars or whatever other programs would be in that time slot, I think that is a potentially huge service if you can achieve that.
And why do you think it is that, for the most part, the science communicators who are very popular, like yourself, like Neil Tyson, I would say that Lawrence Krauss definitely included in that, they tend to be in the world of physics?
I know. I've wondered about that, too. You know, I don't know if it's sort of a self-fulfilling thing where every field has people who are just as good, but there hasn't been sort of a person to rise up that has caused everybody to say, hey, I can do that, and start to do it too.
Right.
Or is it something about sort of physics and astronomy that somehow attracts a person that would be predisposed to talking about these things in a general setting? I don't really know. I will tell you one thing, though. I think we physicists and astrophysicists, put Neil in there as well, I think we have it easier than some other fields, because there is such wonder and grandeur in the universe and these big ideas that speak to the fundamental laws and the fundamental nature of reality, that I feel like nature has given us a break, right? Nature has given us all this wonderful material to work with. And when you get to other subjects like chemistry, I think you could probably do it.
Yeah.
But my guess is it's a little bit more of a challenge.
I took an ecosystem ecology course last year, and you know, we were working on determining the amount of soil carbon in particular plots, and I can understand why that would be a little more of a challenge.
Right. Now, no doubt there's a real way of doing it, and maybe it's been done, because I'm not that familiar with the popular science literature. But I know that Oliver Sacks, who really isn't a chemist per se, he did write a book called Uncle Tungsten, something like that. I can't remember the exact title. But it was his boyhood chemistry experiences, because he loved chemistry as a kid. So there's all sorts of, and he made it really wondrous because he's a great writer and can find the story and everything. But it wasn't really teaching chemistry or delving deeply into chemistry. It was more a child's experience of the wonder of the world through chemistry, a little bit different. So, maybe we've just been given the best raw material as physicists and astronomers.
Especially, I guess, for television, because you can film.
Yes and no. When we were filming The Elegant Universe, String Theory, the constant refrain from every producer on the project was, we have nothing to point the camera at. There's nothing to see.
Graphics.
Because it has to be graphics.
Yeah.
Now, graphics, of course, you can do in any subject. So from that point of view, I wouldn't say that quantum mechanics and string theory are particularly photogenic, but the ideas are sufficiently big that I think an audience is willing to sort of come with you to strange places.
Right. I guess I'm thinking about something like, for example, trying to explain how it is that if you travel close to the speed of light, how things around you would appear.
I agree. That is great stuff. Yeah, no, relativity does provide a wondrous opportunity to visually show people that the world is not what you think it is. And I think that's a great experience. I mean, why do people go to the movies? I think, not always, but people go to the movies because they want to be taken someplace otherworldly. Now, I'm not talking sci-fi. It could be otherworldly in the sense of their experience. They want to see another person's life. They want to have a different kind of emotion than they would if they were just walking down the streets of Manhattan. That's what physics and astrophysics and astronomy does to you every day. Because if you show how the world actually works and it is otherworldly because it isn't what you think it is based on experience, then you're having that experience of being transported to someplace else.
Are there any particular recent scientific discoveries that have either altered or further solidified string theory?
I wouldn't say solidified string theory, but they have solidified our confidence that we know what we're doing. So the discovery of the Higgs boson, this is now a year or so ago, that was an idea that came from math in the 1960s. That was developed through the 70s. At first, people said, no way, it can't be true. Then people came around and said, not only is it not correct to say that it's not true, we almost believe it without the experiment. I mean, I was taught this idea in graduate school with such a definitive presentation by the professor. I didn't know it wasn't a confirmed idea in the 80s. And now, 2012, the math is confirmed. We love that. That's the pattern that we hope that we are on now. And this other, more recent data, which is still too soon to know if it's absolutely correct, the BICEP 2 data, I don't know if you followed this, astronomical observations of the microwave background radiation show evidence of gravitational ripples, ripples in the fabric of space, again, that comes out of Einstein's equations and our cosmological equations, the so-called inflationary theory of cosmology. Again, it's mathematics making a prediction. We look up and the prediction is confirmed. That's the pattern that makes us feel like we know what we're doing. Does that mean string theory is right? No. But does it suggest that it's not crazy to take it seriously? Yeah, it does suggest that.
And so those kinds of discoveries, when you go back and you look at the kind of math that you've been working on, is there anything that you have to change a little bit or make more precise?
Not in some sense, yes. So to fully understand this recent BICEP 2 data, definitely some things need to be fiddled with our understanding of cosmology. If the data is exactly as I said, it still has to be confirmed by other groups and so forth. And that may be an opportunity for string theory to step in and say, hey, here's one way of understanding the data using ideas that are naturally the province of string theory. And that is already starting to happen. Now, it's far too much to say that that means that string theory is right. But it does give a nice feeling that string theory is always standing ready to explain or connect with observation. Perhaps even another one from 1998. It was observed that the universe is expanding ever more quickly, accelerated expansion. It got the 2011 Nobel Prize. That was a wonderful time for the question you're asking, because at that time, nobody thought string theory could allow for a universe that would be speeding up in its expansion. It seemed to contradict the basic equations of string theory. So what did string theorists do? They worked really hard, went into the theory, and found a way to accommodate this observation. And it has changed our thinking about string theory. So there's a way in which string theory is not making direct contact with data, but it is being affected by data in a significant way.
So, World Science U, World Science Festival, do you have anything else coming up in your...
Well, not of that magnitude. A lot of effort now is in developing World Science U, creating new courses, not just me. So we're bringing in other faculty who will be working with us to create what we hope will be the definitive courses in the sciences, physical sciences only being one of those sciences, mathematics, biology, ultimately chemistry, astronomy. So that's sort of a big monumental task in its own right. I am starting to think a little bit about possibly writing a new book, but I don't know enough about what it will be to give you anything definite on that. And the other project that I am also getting into, I did a musical piece. I wrote the words for a kind of space opera that Philip Glass wrote the score for, and Alan Alt, a wonderful artist in the UK, did a film for, Icarus at the Edge of Time, which was one of the most fun things I've ever done, to bring sort of science, real science, and music and film together in a way that kind of amplifies each as opposed to drag each down, which can be the outcome of these unusual unions. So we're now thinking about a sequel to that. So that's the other project on our plate.
Keep it going.
We will definitely do that.
So that was it for Equal Time for Free Thought. Our guest was Brian Green. I'm Matthew Duclair. And if you missed any part of this program or you want to hear it again, share it with friends, visit our website at equaltimeforfreethought.org. And remember to tune in, pay it forward, and question everything. Thank you.